Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Darling and Barrett. My name is Simon Barrett, and I'm joined by my very good friend, veteran trial attorney Manny Barling. Manny, hello.
Hello. I hope everybody across America has had a wonderful, wonderful Thanksgiving.
Did you have a wonderful Thanksgiving?
Yeah, I did absolutely nothing. Is there anything more wonderful on a Thanksgiving weekend than to do nothing?
I didn't do anything either, but I did get a rather interesting email. Wind your mind back a couple of years. Do you remember the infamous CIA Dave, as I called him?
Sure.
Right. Well, the last time I heard from him, he was out of Colombia and retiring to his ranch in Texas. Well, apparently he got bored with retirement, so now he's out in Afghanistan.
Full-time employment. Well, you know, they don't let you out very long. You know, my brother served in Vietnam and Korea. He thought he was retired for life. Served in World War II in Korea, in the South Pacific, and on Iwo Jima, for that matter, which is why I have such strong views about veterans. And he thought he was out for good. Life was going smooth. The Vietnam War started because he had a unique skill related to Vietnam. He must have been I have to think of his age, but he was in his 40s. They forced him back in the military because he was an officer. One day we had basically the FBI show up on our front door and ask where he was because they couldn't find him. So, and coincidentally, he was in the Far East. My oldest brother couldn't find work after World War II, and he became a ship's captain, a merchant marine, and he doubled as the first mate and the captain, depending on what was ever, and did very well with it. So he spent his Vietnam days basically, I would describe it as ferrying ships up and down the Saigon River, and he was not a happy camper about it. He would send me, he would shoot these photos. He would lay on the deck, and as they went up the river, you know, the Viet Cong would just basically shoot at him with the machine guns. And he would send me these photos with these notes, "Do not enlist." And I got his point. So anyway, back to the show. We have John Perry today, Sam Maffey in Cleveland, and Peter Haven, who's returned from being locked in the jungles of probably L.A. Superior Court, which I can really sympathize with him. And so we're going to have an interesting show. So, gentlemen, before we start, well, our opening topic today is now that the fundraiser for Hamas has ended in Israel, let's talk about the benefits. I hear Sam laughing. Sam and I had this discussion earlier in the week, and my view is that a lot of this posturing by Hamas and the rest of them is to encourage other nations, one, to give them street cred, much like a gang, and, of course, to get contributions from the various Arab nations who are just so happy that someone, anyone, has attacked Israel that they just can't wait to send them money. So, John, I'm going to start with you this wonderful Sunday, because I recall you saying to everybody, Clinton's going off on one of these presidential vacations and he should stay here and do something about what's going on there. And seems to me he got it done, didn't he?
Are you serious, Manny?
only when I can stick a needle in you, John.
Well, I think you had a Freudian slip there. You said President Clinton.
Did I? Oh, I'm sorry. I meant President Obama, and I apologize. Go ahead. I didn't mean to besmirch President Clinton.
Well, first of all, I want to congratulate you on your picks. I owe you lunch, but I'm picking UCLA again next week.
Now, there's a guy who likes to buy me lunch. For the record, John called me up and broke my beautiful, peaceful Saturday morning with the prediction that UCLA was going to be Stanford, which brought me to tears laughing. And John is still sticking by UCLA, and we've had this discussion all year. He doesn't like Stanford for football fans. So, John, I'm looking forward to the lunch.
All right, and as far as the Middle East, I think all that's happened is Morsi in Egypt's, his credibility worldwide has been enhanced. and he's emboldened. And I think you guys saw that he's enacting new powers for himself, that his fiats and dictums aren't going to be reviewed by Egypt's courts. And he's becoming a totalitarian. So if that enhances Middle East peace, then you got your wish, Manny.
Oh, I don't think any of this enhances Middle East peace at all, because there can never be peace in the Middle East. And let's make this really clear to our listeners. My view specifically, and I'm interested in everyone else's, and we can go to Peter next with this, is this: there's never going to be peace in the Middle East. And anyone who's read Mishner's The Source and looked at some of this know that this battle's been going on for thousands of years. And if, in my opinion, Israel made one mistake. They should have sent out leaflets that said, you got till noon tomorrow to leave Gaza City and we're going to level it, because the only thing the Arabs understand is to have everything leveled. And in regard to your comments about Morsi, do you really think that motivated him to do something he was going to do anyway? I mean,
John. My credibility. He's going to be difficult to challenge now. And as far as the peace, I don't think, short of disarming Hamas and Hezbollah, how Israel could feel comfortable with this, call it ceasefire, for however long it lasts.
Okay, Peter, we need to hear from you. I need someone to remind John that despots are despots and they don't need motivation from other people. Can you help me out here, Peter?
It feels like my various types of litigation that I'm dealing with. There's never going to be any peace. There's no way to resolve any of this short of absolute final war. There will be no faction in that region of the world that is ever, quote unquote, without arms. There's no ability, in my opinion, to achieve a long lasting peace. They're going to be at war forever. There's really just not much more to say about that. There's always going to be a crisis in that part of the world. Always.
Sam, I have to ask you, if you look at the region, that there are really three powers in play. You have Israel, you have the PLO, and you have Hamas. We in the U.S. have at various times supported Hamas. Even though we more supported, Israel, is there any potential solution?
The only solution I thought it was going to happen is that they were going to annihilate Hamas and go in and take them out and just get rid of those rocket launchers and all that sort of stuff. And I really thought that was going to happen. That's why they were amassed. The other troops on the border, I mean, it's 75,000, and enough was enough. But it looks like the new pharaoh, I think that's what they're calling him in Egypt, decided, to put a deal together. So far it was holding that we know about, and it'll just be a matter, Peter has said, and all you guys have said, it's just a matter of time before something else breaks out. I was amazed that as soon as the ceasefire happened, it took place, all the other militant groups, Hezbollah and others, all praised Hamas that they won, Israel lost, and they can expect more rockets to come down from the north, from the east, wherever they can. Israel's damned if it does and damned if it doesn't. And if it's got to give some time, it's just too fragile. I mean, they want to destroy Israel, and it's just the Hamas and, Hezbollah and some other ones, and people have to recognize that around this world, and let Israel defend itself, and they do to a certain point. And then when the media, what kind of bothers me, the media start scorekeeping. 116 Palestinians dead versus only 3 Israelis dead. And that starts to get to me, because, and Manny and I had talked about this early in the week, it's the Israelis protectors, they build bomb shelters. They have air raid sirens. They don't, hide their weapons, in schools and hospitals and whatnot. But, Hamas doesn't. They spend more time hiding their rockets than they do protecting their own people. And I really believe part of it is to bring that score up, so the rest of the world's going, oh, see,
they don't hit the Israelis again. You know, they're beating up on these poor Palestinians because it's a civilian carnage. And Israel starts to feel this bully. They become the bully in the eyes of the certain Western countries and whatnot, and they back off. And then it's like deja vu all over again when the next group of rockets comes raining down on them.
Well, let me add something to that. I think one of the problems that we're facing is that, you know, you can say your dog is black, but if everybody sees it's white, it's white. And I don't care what the Palestinians say. The rest of the world knows they're getting their butts kicked, and they can put on a good face, but that face is really for the poor and the stupid in their country who don't get it. And they think that they're convincing their people with sort of almost like smoke and mirrors that they've actually achieved something. But when you listen to the interviews of people on the ground in those countries, especially with the advent of multimedia communications, they don't buy it. They know what the score is. They know that, and they don't love Hamas and all the rest of those. But we're talking about a culture that would rather sacrifice their people than use any other means. So when you're dealing with someone who doesn't care what the ultimate cost of battle is, yeah, sure. If you've got a side that's willing to charge you with 10,000 people and gamble that 500 left standing will be enough to win the war, then that war is a very difficult war. So I think that is a bigger factor. But and the question that I raise is, okay, assume you follow my terrible strategic decision, which would amount to multiple deaths in Gaza. Would anybody care? Certainly the only ones who care would not be the Arab countries. Would they hate Israel more? No, they couldn't hate them any more than they do. So at the end of the day, what is the difference and what changes the outcome of this when you're dealing with a culture whose only goal is to destroy another culture, even if they destroy themselves in the process? Does anybody disagree with that?
There are some rumors that a ship out of Iran is headed in that direction to restock Hamas with missiles. That bothers me greatly.
Well, as opposed to shipping them through tunnels? I mean, what's the difference? They're going to get them in there anyway, and the end result of this is the only way to slow this down is to bomb them back to the Dark Ages and do it every couple of years. And one of my disagreements, John and I have debated this at lunch, is I did not agree with going into Iraq after 9/11. I really believe the best solution was to just get out there and bomb Iraq back to the Stone Age, bomb out all of Saddam Hussein's various palaces, and say, okay, guys, go spend your oil money cleaning up the mess. And I think that's a better solution than the one that's being used now. Right now, everybody's pussyfooting around the issues because, as Sam points out, they're more concerned with body counts. Right, Sam?
Yes, I really believe that. Especially when you just you go online and read the different newspapers. The BBC, I thought, would just keep it with like a medal count, you know, with like watching body count, you know, like the Olympics, they're sad in what they do and the reporting. And we talk about our quote-unquote left-wing media biased, if you may. Sometimes I believe it, sometimes I don't. I haven't made up my mind on that. But there's definitely a pro-Palestinian bias when the reporting's going on. It's just amazing to me. I'll see Israel do a surgical strike. They'll even announce announcements, to the building that your building is going to be bombed. You have an hour to leave or whatnot. And they bomb it and they follow through. Hopefully the people are smart and they leave, or someone tells or forces them to leave. But then you never see that. You never hear about that. But what you'll see is the bomb. Car on fire, people raising their fist and yelling and screaming, a poor woman, wailing over a loss of a loved one. But you don't see anything about it. I couldn't imagine my children having to go to school and every day they have to, with the air raid, with those rockets that they are not accurate. You never know where they're going to land coming over. You know, and every day, air raid, air raid, air raid, and that goes on. And the whole, and I think part of Hamas's plan, and it's not so dumb on their part, is to disrupt Israeli economic activity. And, you know, for a whole week, in southern Israel, I mean, there's nothing going on. I mean, that has to hurt their economy. That has to hurt their lifestyle, that, you know, and the stress that one must be under, you know, with your family constantly, you know, running to air raid shelters. It's terrible. It's terrible, and it should be reported more, but it never will be. Because Israel is a bad guy.
Yeah. John, I'm going to ask you a question in this. One of my feelings, and having been there, and I don't know if anyone else has been there, traveled there besides myself, is I've always had the feeling that the Arabs like to keep their populace, like their women, barefoot and pregnant. You know, they just don't want them to really get bright enough, educated enough, or whatever, to answer, ask any question which might in some way impair their goals. So in some respects, they don't care that we're bombing them back, the poor down to, because if there's too much peace, there's too much for too long a period of time, personally, I think the citizens start to figure the whole thing out. And I think a lot of them have. So keeping these people from having a better life enforces these Muslim goals of, you know, keeping this archaic society going. Does anybody disagree with me?
Well, Manny, as I've, my commentary from earlier shows, which you scoffed at, I never embraced the Arab Spring, and I wasn't willing to give Obama his second Nobel Prize for supporting the movement. I said, anytime you replace a secular-leaning Arab leader with a strident Islamic militarist, it's bad for everyone, including the indigenous population, like the Shah and Mubarak. And I think this was entirely predictable to all those who have any sense of history.
I agree with you, and I've never embraced the Arab Spring either, because there is no such thing as an Arab Spring. It's just a, you know, time out between wars.
We should be supporting the secular-leaning Arab leaders, not supporting the removal of them.
Well, I don't know that we're supporting the removal of anybody. I think that's
there
just the way.
Was.
We don't. Are you saying we suddenly have control over who's doing what within those countries?
No, Mubarak was told, get out. We're not supporting you, and that was a huge mistake.
No,
and now
well,
the people of the region are going to suffer, and, yeah, they're going to be
okay.
Under Sharia law.
Well, let me take you back to Vietnam for a moment. How would we enforce him staying just because we support him? You know, and I'm going to come back to Peter with this. You know, this is where John and I get into our screaming arguments at lunch, although we never scream at each other, just intellectually, is that I don't believe that you can change these things. I mean, you can't just get up and say, well, I'm going to support this group or that group, and it's going to change the politics of the country, because it doesn't. And John, that's the problem. Do you disagree with me, Peter?
No, there's no way to really directly change or impact anything in this region of the world, in my opinion. I don't think we're ever going to give up trying, and I don't think we're ever going to succeed at accomplishing hardly anything. I shudder to think what this region of the world would be like if the Israelis weren't there to do whatever they do. It's just a mess, and I don't think that anything that we do is ultimately going to change anything in that part of the world.
I couldn't agree with you more. And you know, you spent time working in Washington, D.C. when you were a young lawyer. That was the prevailing feeling I had when I spent time in D.C. is a frustration among everybody in Congress and anyone who traveled anywhere throughout this part of the Middle East, that they were just basically spinning their wheels. And I think that's probably what you saw, too, right?
We're having the same conversations. I've been listening to these conversations for decades. We're talking about the exact same issues that we were talking about 20 or 30 years ago. The names change, the faces change, some of the battle lines change, but it's the same old story over and over again. I watched a episode on the History Channel last night about about Moses leading the Jews out of Egypt, and it was done from the perspective of a military campaign, and it talked about all these battles all along the way, and then the battle for Canaan and the military troop movements, and this battle is just going to rage on forever.
Yep, I agree.
Okay. And Sam, question for you. Should we just leave the region alone and let it implode all by itself?
Before I answer that, when Manny and John, when you guys go out for lunch, do you go out in public or do you go to each other's house?
No, actually,
you guys
are
in public, you get thrown out of places.
Hey, John,
no.
how could you bet in favor of UCLA? You know they didn't want to win that game.
I like UCLA, and Manny likes USC, but I want to say, Sam, good point.
Yep.
I wear a burqa anytime I'm out with Manny. Because he's ashamed to be seen in public with me.
And I have good cause, my friend, good cause. No, I one of the things, and I'm sure Peter will attest to that, lawyers spend a lot of money, and everywhere I go, I'm renowned for large meetings, picking up checks, or clients who pick up big checks. So, Peter, they always welcome you back, don't they?
Yeah, in theory.
The power of that plastic credit card when used incorrectly is amazing.
Okay, Sam, back to you and my question.
Okay. I think we should, it goes back to everyone looked the other way when we had the strong man, the Mubarak's, the Shah's. We always, kind of wanted them to do all the dirty work, and they did. And then now that's the so-called Arab Spring, which I agree with the other with Manny and John and Peter, really didn't, it sounds nice, Arab Spring, but it really isn't, and especially when you see how the new pharaoh is acting in Egypt. And now they're already rioting like crazy over there, like it was, like the Arab Spring. It's a repeat. Who knows how long he's going to stay in. Maybe the Egyptian military is going to step back in. I don't think in regards to that. It's so unstable. It's consistently unstable. I think we need to – Israel is our ally. Yeah, I think Israel can take care of Israel with the help of the United States. We talked about this last Sunday, and their own scientists, their own economy and whatnot, and let them, let's see someone attack them. I think the United States does hold back Israel, and I think it's lucky for a lot of Arab nations that they do, and an Arab terrorist. I think they would fear Israel unchained as opposed to feeling Israel has – the United States government, whether it's Republican or Democrat, has a leash on them. And maybe they wouldn't be screwed around with so much.
Did you say Egyptian pharaohs? Is that what I heard you say?
Well, that's what they're calling Morsi as the new pharaoh.
Oh, yeah. I call Morsi the new pharaoh. Yeah.
That's good. I like that.
Yeah. So, let me throw
I stole it from somebody else, I'm not going to, I couldn't take credit, but it is good with the way he did that.
Yeah.
I mean, just how he just came in there and he called for that. But I really think Israel, if they would go in, for my history, I remember they never negotiated with terrorists. They would get the hijacking and they would always fight back. That was it. You knew Israel, was going to strike back, and they kept continuing to strike back, and they did. And for a while, they kept the lid on the pot. The pot's always simmering, no question about it. But I always felt that, looking back throughout history and all the wars and whatnot, that whenever Israel was allowed to do its thing, it did so brilliantly and war-wise and won, and the Arabs would have to back off and they'd start bickering with themselves and fighting and whatnot. But now what I don't like is how much money comes out of our treasury to support 14 or 15 countries and the PLO, which hates Israel too, tons of money, and they hate Israel. I think we all know that some of those missiles that Hamas now has is a direct, comes from Libya, comes from Egypt, we know how it's going to get there, but it's our tax dollars that bought the damn thing, probably, and they were used to fire against our only ally. And that has to stop. I mean, why are we, I never can understand why we are giving monies and aid and effort and who else in cash money to countries that want to destroy our alleged only ally in the region and the only democracy. And someone explained that to me, I'd be a happy man.
Everybody's making money off it.
We'll come back to that in a second. I want to add two historical comments, and then we'll come back to it. One is that, you know, take a look at the Russian Revolution. There was a second Russian Revolution less than 6 months later, and the real revolution, Russian Revolution isn't May Day, it's in October. And in almost every country, this unrest is followed by a change of government. I think Morsi is like toast. His regime will pop up one day and will be gone, and it will be replaced by another one, and it won't necessarily be a better one. And the first ruler to take over, almost like the first guy who takes over a company, is usually lost along the way because of the nature of the business. And the second one is the historical aspect of it, is that when you take a look at any type of quick change, including the United States, that period from the 1780s to the, it stopped after the War of 1812, almost 22 years later, a significant portion of the U.S. still supported Britain, and there was a problem, and there were still all the things going on until that moment. And let's go in the very last part of all of this, is the U.S. is undergoing some of the same problems. Our greatest generation came back from World War II united against communism and all these other issues in the world. Second, third, fourth generations, and now a generation who didn't even experience the Vietnam War nor any of the other things that our generations did, don't remember the lessons of history. Well, that's sort of what's going on in Israel, is after 1947, all the way through Golda Meir's, and the government were occupied by freedom fighters. Those freedom fighters are dying off, or if not totally died off, but close to it in Israel. So we have second and third generation of people running Israel who did not experience what they did. And, Sam, I think that dilutes what goes on in Israel right now. So Peter, you were about to comment, so jump in.
No. I agree with all of that.
Then let's give it to John, who's our resident historian. John, do you agree with me historically how one revolution, it doesn't signify a total change of government, that there are still other changes that can take place?
It depends on the situation, Manny. I can think of a lot of despots in power for generations, Cuba, North Korea, Vietnam. But there's a couple things that really irritate me. First is the greatest generation. I find it amusing that the greatest generation spawned the summer of love and hacky sack kicking kids. Secondly, I don't like the term disproportionate response. And Sam, that's basically what you were saying, because the Palestinians are seen as victims, so any response is seen as disproportionate. I can think of a couple examples, like when a fly is irritating me, I do engage in disproportionate response. I kill it. And secondly, many people would think this is an appropriate response, but I think it's disproportionate. Anytime Simon's opining on any subject, they change the dial. That's a disproportionate response in my eyes, not defending yourself.
You know, John, you return to an attack on my generation. Just remember, my generation does not watch Bill and Ted and grow up doing dope in high school like you did. We all went to college, got educations, and changed everything in this country, including the civil rights laws down the line. Your generation, as usual, has done nothing, as I repeat to you all the time at lunch. I'll stand by mine. You can't stand by yours because most of yours are in rehab.
Oh, I'm not going to accept the greatest generation spawning kids who were nothing but Woodstock attending, mescaline dropping, hippies and beatniks.
Well, that's fine. You were once one of them, weren't you?
No, so, not at all, Manny.
Excuse me.
That. I always had short hair.
let me guess, John. You're of the generation that, yeah, I tried it, but I didn't inhale.
Have to exercise the Fifth Amendment privilege on that one.
Yeah, well, as John, as you've always told me about criminal law, that says it all about you, doesn't it? but seriously,
John,
for a moment, you know, I have a theory for those. See, John, you don't have children, and I get whacked by my wife every once in a while because she'll go to me, what a dumb thing to say or whatever about someone on a show, and I'll say to her, you know, honey, you don't have children. Until you have children, you don't understand. And the truth is, and I don't know how many people, I know Sam has quite a few children, is what happens with children frequently is you have a very conservative generation like our parents' generation. Mine didn't drink, smoke, or swear. We're just a classic Victorian, perfect British parents and on the outskirts, on the outside, as you well understand, Simon. But, you know, basically they raised four drinking, smoking, hard-partying, wacky children because we just basically rebelled against that type of and chafed at that lifestyle. And what happens most frequently is that conservative parents begat wild and crazy children. Wild and crazy parents, like my ex-wife and myself, begat conservative children. My children don't drink, smoke, never even experimented with drugs, don't do with any of that stuff, and complete opposite of their parents were during that period of time. And their children, if they would finally get married and have some, which is not wonderful either, will probably be just wild and crazy because their parents are boring and conservative.
John, I have to ask you, don't you think that we have enough strife within our borders that we should just stop all foreign aid and, you know, spend the money at home?
No, Simon, as I've opined on previous occasions, why do we even have a State Department if we're not going to utilize it? We should try to promote freedom and independence around the world. And I'm not talking just democracy. I'm talking about protecting individual rights. And
okay.
I think, and
how successful have we been?
Well, I don't even think we're successful in this country. Like, look at our voting laws. What a joke they are. You guys and the organization Voters Without Borders are suing every state that tries to enact any type of voter guarantee laws as far as identification.
Yeah, especially when they favor the Republican Party.
Yeah, Voters Without Borders, Manny, you're probably a charter member.
No, but no,
John, you're like someone on CNN, a talking head. You know, you're avoiding the question. You know, we have lots of strife at home. You know, we have lots of poor people. So why are we spending dollars we don't have to support people that don't even like us?
Simon, ask yourself this. Why is it the more money we spend on poverty programs, the greater percentage of people go into poverty? Have you ever asked yourself that?
I haven't, but we've never had the dollars to spend on poverty programs.
That's not true, Simon. Billions have been wasted.
Because we're too stinking busy giving money to people, you know, in other countries that don't like us.
Simon, that's called, how should I say, exerting your will or imposing your will on other countries.
Yeah, like Vietnam. We were really good at that one, weren't we?
Well, look how that was. That's another discussion. But, Simon, I don't think that spending more money on great society programs is going to reduce poverty. If you look at the statistics, it doesn't. More people go into poverty, and that's what bothers me because it doesn't benefit the recipient. It only benefits the dispenser of the check.
Oh, okay.
That's not true, John. You're being so narrow-minded on that, as you always are. And, no, you know, John, the issue is charity begins at home. we've allowed the infrastructure of our country to deteriorate severely, whether it was bridges in Minnesota that collapsed or whatever the various reasons are. The fact is we've done a very poor job of keeping up our particular, part of our bargain with our country and keeping it basically running. I'm struggling for words because I don't know how to describe what I see as the decay in our infrastructure. You have to rebuild it every certain years. So to have a country that's decaying and an atmosphere where it's extremely important to maintain our country in the highest security level is really terrible, and that's what's happening. And at times we have to sacrifice some of our foreign policy for the good of our own country, and we're not doing that.
Implementing that policy, you'll have more Detroits.
What do you mean, would have more Detroits?
Yep.
What do you mean by more Detroits?
It's a war zone. It's destroyed.
Oh, I see.
The money that's gone in there.
Okay. I think we need the voice of reason. Hopefully.
You let me know when you find it.
Yeah, on this topic, I don't think Peter is going to be the voice of reason you would like, because I think Peter agrees with my comments, essentially. Don't you, Peter?
Yeah, essentially. There was one thing that John said that I did have a lot of currency in my mind, no pun intended, and that is that a lot of these forms of charitable giving benefit the ones writing the checks. And, the answer, why are we giving money to people who hate us or do whatever they do to undermine us? Why is money flowing the way that it does? And in my opinion, it's an age-old story. Someone somewhere is benefiting from it, and I don't know how and I don't know why, but what happens internally within our own borders is just a subset of, I think, what happens all over the world with the ebb and flow of money. People send it to places where they expect to get some type of return or they expect to get some type of profit. And if it's not their money, they're less fiscally concerned about it. And I have no idea why some of our money flows in some of the directions that it does, but I do feel at the end of the day somebody's making some money off of it.
Well, let me explain this much to you. Wait a minute. Let me come back to this topic. People think that we just write a check to other nations for foreign aid. That's not what happens. We give the money to American corporations who supply aid in manners that aren't necessarily desired by the countries that we're giving aid to. We may give them, how about genetically modified wheat to a country who doesn't want to grow genetically modified wheat? How about the tanks that we sell? Some countries are the leftover, out-of-date used tanks from GM and Ford, and so they can make some money and not be stuck with dead inventory. So there's somewhat of a conspiracy, particularly among Congress, because if you look at the congressmen who really advocate foreign aid the most, coincidentally, they're the ones in the districts with the most number of defense contractors who benefit by it. Every case, you're going to see that's true. And that's one of the areas why I don't agree with John. I mean, if you don't want to give aid to the poor, but yet you're willing to give aid to American businesses, which you don't basically support. So you cannot say, I'm not going to give aid to Americans who need it, when you're willing to give aid to American corporations who don't need it, shouldn't get it, and don't deserve it. You're talking out of both sides of your mouth, so someone save me from picking on John right now.
No, picking on John is always fun.
Well, Manny, I don't resent your criticism, especially when it strays from the truth and reality. I don't support aid to corporations. That was you guys' stimulus plan in TARP. I never supported that.
Oh, so you're saying to me that supporting foreign aid is not supporting aid to corporations? I mean, John, think about it. Who do we buy those arms from? Who benefits from
that?
Well,
let me put it this way. Now that I've been going through withdrawals, I am for supporting a corporation go in to anywhere, Mexico, Egypt, Vietnam, and make Twinkies again.
Yeah. And, you know, John, they will still be making them in Mexico. And speaking of nation building, I'm tired of everybody talking about nation building in the Middle East where it's a waste of time. You want a nation build? Do us all a favor. Let's just take over Mexico and clean up that piece of shit country, wipe out all of its basic governing people, and turn that country back into to the people where it belongs.
The only problem is, Manny, we're moving toward Mexico on our own anyway. So they might
not
want to be part of this.
Oh, please, John. You know, I know you're trying to make an argument, but try and make a good one. The problem with Mexico is the government's more dishonest than the friggin' drug dealers. And they always have been more dishonest than the drug dealers, going back to Pancho Villa and the rest of them. I grew up here, as you did. I've had a full view, having vacationed and fished in Mexico since the early 60s, of everything that goes on in Mexico, and it is disgusting. I mean, basically, this government is a government of the rich. They're occupational government for basically Spanish in descent who don't care about the basic people in Mexico who are generally of Indian descent. To them, they're just trash, and they shit on them every single day they can because, you know why? Because they can get away with it. Because the U.S. government's been supporting their efforts forever and ever and ever.
Manny, I have to ask an off-topic question. Do you think that NAFTA helped or hindered the Mexican situation?
First of all, NAFTA was a scheme of American corporations to rip off the United States and to destroy the American poor, particularly minorities. I opposed it so strenuously in the time that Ashley just couldn't believe, and not only myself, but another one of my clients, we actually were speaking regularly against it because we both predicted it would be result in the kind of unemployment our country's facing right now. And everything I predict about NAFTA has essentially happened to this country. It has devastated America by allowing jobs to be sent to Mexico. Has it helped Mexico? Sure, because Mexico doesn't have to deal with its problems. We're always letting them off the hook. Even immigration. Why are there immigration problems in Mexico? Because Mexicans can't stay in their own country because their government rips them off so badly, doesn't do anything for them, so they're forced to come here looking for essentially what is aid. So we're allowing Mexico to export all of its social problems to the United States, and we're not doing a damn thing about it. That's what bothers me. And as again, I've had the privilege of growing up in Southern California and seeing it firsthand. I live in an area that's got more than its share of Latino population, and as John will attest, for a number of years of my life, one of my clients, we took a $4 million medical clinic in East L.A. and took it up to $100 million a year in business, and I spent my days almost every day down there cleaning up that part of the community. I've listened to Latinos. I listen to what their stories. I listen to what goes on, and believe me, the United States is completely missing the boat, which reminds me, I want to shift off to that article about racism in North Carolina, which is part of this conversation. At the same time, John, that you're saying all this, we're trying to run Latinos out of this country. The same way, to a great extent, the white population during the Roaring Twenties hated all the Italians and saw them as trash. So here we have a country that is essentially taking whoever the latest minority is and trying to run them out of our country. I mean, What is that about? I mean, what is with our country? Can you explain, John, why that goes on so much in our country?
I would, Manny, but Sam's an astute observer. I'd really like to get his opinion on this.
Well,
John ducking.
I was going to say deflecting.
No, ducking's a better word.
I think the best way to view it is John took the fifth on that one.
Yeah, and it wasn't
I kind of liked what you guys were talking about a little earlier, which was the it's not the first revolution, it's the revolution that comes after the first revolution we have to keep our eyes and ears on. And I think that's what we're seeing now with the so-called, with the new pharaoh. He's the, you know, they got rid of Mubarak, that was the first revolution, and now we're seeing him, the Muslim Brotherhood rise up. I really like that point that you brought up in history. It's watch for that second and maybe even the third revolution that comes right after that. And those are what we have to keep our eyes on, and that was a very good point. As far as, I always thought Rock Throw was, 100% right. The, that China, that NAFTA was, that China sucking sound was going to be all positive stuff just going down, right? Wealth and whatever going down to Mexico, jobs, and all we got back were, the hole in the bagel, as they say. We didn't get anything except their headaches and aggravation and whatnot. It hasn't worked. I'm glad you were against it many years ago. I didn't understand that. I was too young. I just knew that in this area, a lot of the unions were very adamant against it. They were pro-Democrat. The president, who was a Democrat, was the one who pushed it. And it really started, that's when I started to realize that, the power of, the corporations and big special interests. Here they were, Republicans back in the 90s were against NAFTA and GATT, and Clinton, the Democrats, were pushing it, at least in Washington speak, in Washington term. And then when it got passed, it blew me away that all these unions who were adamantly against it, and rightfully so, still embrace Clinton as their hero. But he's the one who shoved that thing, he was the guy who whipped the votes up to get it passed and, worked it to get it done. And he spit right in his, constituency, the main constituency's face with this thing. And I understand, obviously where I live, there's not a lot of big Latino population. We have a small one, but not, a big one, of course, if you guys do. But I do know I have a lot of family that's in Southern California, and my son's back here for Thanksgiving, blessedly. And he was just telling me, he goes, Dad, if we ever sent all of the immigrants, if they picked them up in a trucks and truck them back to Mexico and let them off there, Southern California, no one would know what to do. So who would cut the grass? Who would clean the pools? Who would do this? Who would do that? Because I don't see where the workforce comes from. They are doing these jobs that no one else wants to do. And as he said, we were talking about it, the big question is, why don't Americans want to do those jobs anymore?
And well, that's what we were talking about. First of all, they never have, Sam. Go back to the 20s. Most of New York City were built by, Eastern European immigrants, and particularly Italians. And New York City. Well, look at the St. Pierre Hotel, which I like a great deal. And those wonderful mosaic ceilings, all in traditional Italian frescoes. Nobody in the U.S. knew how to do those. You take even the topic of the infamous shirt-making fire that caused the clothing union to start. Those were basically Eastern European Jewish women who were locked in because they thought so little of them, they wouldn't even let them out to save their lives. So we have a long history of basically dumping on whoever the latest immigrant is. So the low man in the totem pole right now is the Latinos, but the Latinos are smart, they're really hard workers, and guess what? They've embarrassed the African-American community, and in L.A., those two have no good relationship because they compete for the same jobs, and the truth is, given an opportunity, most people in Los Angeles would much rather hire a Latino than someone from the African-American community. And if we have listeners who are African-Americans, if the shoe fits, wear it. And ask yourself why people in Los Angeles feel that way. And that's one of the problems. So, here we have another group of people who come to the United States who want to be part of the American dream, and the powers that be would like to eliminate them, and the powers that be just happen to be, the classic white race in the United States, and they're trying to deny that opportunity to another set of immigrants. The race changes, but the story is the same. And I don't know if anyone sees that any differently than I do, but we have a long history of this. It happened to the Irish, but people forget when the Irish came to the United States, most of them didn't speak English. They spoke only Gaelic. So they were treated the same way because they had come from another country, didn't speak English, and therefore were not, well-received. And that's the problem in our country right now. So anyway, Please, someone get me off this.
Oh, okay, Tito, it has to be you. You're a Southern California resident. You understand the race situation. Do you have some comments?
Well, I'm not even sure what the question is anymore, to be honest with you, but I understand what the issues are because I've been, you know, everybody talks about these issues all the time. And I'm afraid my comments are a bit more philosophical. I remember in law school, I took a constitutional a seminar, and one of the things we talked about in the seminar was, why do we even regulate our borders? What is it that we're trying to control or protect or stop or limit? And it was suggested by one of my classmates, and the professor seemed to agree with it, and this was at UCLA, John, that, you know, what would the world be like? What would America be like if we really didn't have immigration policies, if we really didn't have controlled borders? And we just let anybody come here who wanted to be here. And the key to being here was working and surviving. And if you don't work and survive, you're not going to have much of an incentive to stay. And I don't know if that really addresses any of the concerns that people are talking about. And I'm not really saying that I endorse that particular view, but it is interesting to think about it. What Manny says and what Sam says are true. These people are incredibly hardworking, and they do a lot of jobs that nobody else wants, apparently nobody else wants to do. And that's just a fact of life, and I don't believe it's unique just to Southern California. I think it's unique everywhere. As a group, they're a very powerful political force because their numbers are growing and they're very major players in the economic game. They are, in many respects, the lifeblood of many of the industries that function in throughout the United States in general and Southern California in particular. They keep it flowing.
John, Peter, do you agree with me? They are also very politically savvy.
I think they're very savvy. They're very astute. They're very savvy. They're hardworking, and they're very aware of everything that goes on around it. And you know, one of the things that Americans suffer from, the traditional notion of Americans, you know, the Caucasian American, is that we tend to be unaware of many of the things going on around us, and other cultures, for obvious reasons, are much more so aware, and Hispanics in particular, in my opinion, are very aware.
Good point.
Manny, you started this conversation off on the subject of racism, and we drifted off a little bit. But there are a couple of really, really interesting cases that, occurred last week. Would you care to elaborate?
Well, I don't have them in front of me, so I'm going to speak briefly on it. One of them is a local story that is a little more personal. John and I discussed this a little bit. There's an incident in Orange County in Yorba Linda, which, as I always point out, is Richard Nixon's birthplace, which has become somewhat of an upscale Orange County area. And they basically an African-American police officer moved in the neighborhood, of which is a little unheard of in that area, and was shocked to find that his children were being abused with racial epithets. And it became so bad that someone shot gas pellets at his car, and I mean, there were rocks thrown through the window, and he finally gave up and moved out of the neighborhood, and they succeeded in forcing him out. And we haven't seen a lot of that, or publicly, or seen it much in the newspapers, and that story did not spend enough time in the newspapers. But it gets back to one of my discussions, that these happen in primarily white Republican enclaves, and here it is again in another white Republican enclave in Orange County. And the problem is that racism is not dead in the U.S. It's very common. And at the same time, we had a story that was finally published out of North Carolina, a little town called Graham outside of Raleigh-Durham, which is not far from Charlotte in the downtown area, that has gone from 700 Latinos to a population, I believe, of about 17,500. And the sheriff has embarked on a crusade to get rid of Latinos out of the town, and recently was sued by the federal government for basically being discriminatory. So this has not stopped, and I say this to a background of reading articles on how the Republicans are going to reach out to minorities to make them all-inclusive in future Republican activities, and here we have this backdrop in a primarily Republican areas where just the opposite is happening. And I think it's going to kill the Republican Party. Sam basically rails about this all the time to me, about these guys being idiots and what are they thinking about. And I have the same point, Sam. You want to add your comments? Because you're in the Midwest.
Well,
you're not really part
actually,
of it.
No, a little bit more on the Yul Belinda story. Didn't they also slash eight tires?
Yeah, all the tires on both cars, yes.
Yeah. I mean, ugly, ugly, ugly. Okay, I'll be quiet. Sam, mic is yours.
Why do you think it is that a story like that didn't have legs? You know, I mean, we have the one, the Trayvon, I can't remember the kid's name. We had that incident, and it was a racist incident, and, you know, there was all the usual people running to, you know, to get public, you know, publicity and live off it, and, you know, and how insensitive the police department was, I think, you know, and but that thing had legs. It played. I mean, this story, yes, no one got killed, but it just shows that racism is alive and well in certain areas. I find it, you know, if you guys wouldn't have sent that to me, I would never have known it happened. And that, to me, that's shocking that we've reached out and we've kind of stopped racism a little bit better. We've re-elected a black president. You know, we have famous, you know, movies. There's a lot of great movie celebrities who are black, African-American, and entrepreneurs who are doing well who are African-American, and et cetera, et cetera. I'm amazed a story like that didn't have legs and didn't catch on, and people weren't talking about it. That's shocking to me.
Simon, correct me if I'm wrong, because you're closer than I am. My recollection is Trayvon Martin, which we did a number of shows on earlier in the year, was that it really did not get immediate coverage. It took a little bit of while. In fact, our friend Dave Neckel and others down there really pushed it also, and then suddenly it exploded, I think, when Nancy Grace did one of her obnoxious shows, seemed to have brought it to the surface. Am I wrong?
No, you're entirely right. But it has died off again. You know, Nancy only goes for, shock and horror aspect.
That's because the trial's been put off into infinity, and even lawyers lose interest in their cases if they're put off long enough. But soon it'll be back. The early part of the year, they have some dates coming up, and it will be back in the public eye. And I can assure you, once they assign a trial date and some motions start getting scheduled, it'll light up. Don't you agree?
Oh, it certainly will.
So man, in a, I guess it's in a negative way, there's probably a little incidents happening all across America. Racism could be reverse racism too, but it's happening all across. But if it doesn't get a Nancy Grace type thing or something, like someone gets the hooks on it and brings it up to the national forefront, it's really not going to get talked about. Am I reading you right on that one? That you guys locally might be able to do something locally and about some racist things like that. But if it doesn't get up into where it's got to get, into the net, it won't get into the nation's conscience to be talked about. And that's pretty sad, too.
Well, it's very sad, Sam. Jan and I have worked on a number of different cases, and pretty much
we got shut down. You know, if the national press had no interest, you know, it doesn't matter how good the story is. You know, if it doesn't involve a cute little white girl, you know, being dead or missing, you can't get there.
No, I mean, it's funny because you said, you know, the one story that was in, I didn't do a lot of with family here and friends and, you know, the Thanksgiving. By the way, I hope everybody had a great Thanksgiving to the panel and, of course, the listening audience. I had a great one. But I didn't watch that much. And today, everyone left, you know, just melancholy. So I was doing some catching up on the news, so to speak. And I was amazed, like, one of the major news stories, at least online, was how bad Lindsay Lohan was as Liz Taylor. That's all that I saw. I don't know, you know, it's like, geez, that's the story? I mean, that's what I missed all weekend. I'm glad I didn't pay attention to the Thanksgiving Thanksgiving week media, and along, of course, with Black Friday. But, you know, it's amazing to me that stories like that you sent me, and I've got some other people, and I'm sure you guys get them too, that are just horrific, need to be talked about, and they don't. We've got to talk about Honey Boo Boo, and here we go back to that again. Sorry, I brought up Honey Boo Boo.
You know, I'm a member of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, and for years sat on the executive committee, which consists of executive producers and other people. And through my friends, including the Cappers, who are also in the news business, I have dinner frequently with famous newscasters, and hardly a conversation comes up with us where I don't say to them, you know, this cherry-picking of news is offensive. And they go, well, you know, we put on what the network lets us put on. And to a great extent, the quality of news is so diluted. Something John points out to me all the time, except John has this sort of weird view that Fox News is actually put on news, which, you know, still is shocking. You know, but the reality is, you know, I turn on the news sometimes just to see what some of the announcers I know are doing, and it's like, oh, look at the little pet. He was found trapped behind this. And so, you know, they're going for the cutesy, and the cutesy isn't really news. It's just what I describe as puff pieces, and that's probably the technical word in the industry. And right now there's an obsession with putting puff pieces. It's almost like we're in a generation not unlike the Fred Astaire years, where people basically went to see dance movies because they couldn't deal with the reality of their time. And I think people are becoming numb to this horrible financial time, and then many of them are just not dealing with it by not dealing with any kind of news that in any way upsets them. And
well,
John,
is there any news organization out there that actually has news anymore?
Oh, I mean, Fox. You know, I mean, that's not news. I mean, you know, after all, I mean, what would be life without Karl Rove and all the rest of them talking about how, you know, Romney's going to dominate the election? I mean, you know, and they're always, you know, so objective in everything they say, and they always seem to have their pulse on the heart of all Americans. Oops, all white Americans of right-wing descent. So, John, you want to defend that piece of crap that we refer to as Fox News, or are you just not going to defend them today?
Man, you know I support Fox News 100%. It's the only unbiased network fair and balanced on the air.
Did you say unbalanced? Or
fair and balanced. But
hey, look, this is supposed to be a news program, not a comedy show.
Well, we're
discussing Fox.
They don't treat Obama like Ned Beatty, and a lot of people like you guys are offended by that, so I understand.
So, what are your thoughts about Grover Norquist?
I love Grover Norquist, of course. How could I not? But I wanted to comment real quick on that racism story. I mentioned this to Manny during the week, and I guess he hasn't considered it as yet. I'm instinctively skeptical of any stories that charge racism, because looking at this story, I feel like I can speak for my friends and neighbors. most people love having police officers, law enforcement personnel as neighbors, regardless of the color. And also, racism now in the American mainstream media has been defined as, other than Fox, of course, has been defined as disagreeing with a Democrat who happens to be black. That's basically the definition in the lexicon of America today.
You know, John, without you, we would never be able to track the Ku Klux Klan audience. It would be very difficult.
Well, I don't know, Manny. Judging by your earlier provocative comments, a lot of them might have agreed with you. Would never say anything like that.
Say what?
About this war between the blacks and Mexicans fighting over jobs and
well, just go sit down in East L.A. and they'll tell you that right to your face. I'm not starting something I don't hear a lot.
Oh, Manny, very provocative. I just think it's funny that you would accuse someone else of racism if you're claiming that.
No, John. I'm saying that racism permeates our country, and the truth is it's probably a natural response of every species, and you can't get rid of it. That I don't deny. But the fact is a large portion of our country are in denial, including you, who keep telling me throughout the years you've never seen racism. It doesn't exist.
Well, Manny, don't people want law enforcement personnel as their neighbors regardless of color?
John, you and I know we agree on that, and I was the first one to bring that up in our conversation. In fact, I told you a story about my law enforcement neighbor when I was in college who loved to tell me stories about chasing famous minority football players through the ghetto. And so anyway, to make a long story short, no. And the problem with racism is being pushed under the carpet in our country, and that people are talking only about what's politically correct and not the truth. And the fact that people are frequently offended by my comments because they don't want to hear the truth, and I don't want to quote Nicholson, and that they don't want to deal with the reality of what's going around, so they'd rather work around the surfaces. I thought all too often that Obama, who I don't agree with and is not my favorite president, shirked that issue too many times instead of dealing with the racism against him straight up. Because if you want to tell me that the support that the reason most of your friends dislike him so much is not based on the fact that he's also black, I'm going to fall over off this radio show and laugh. It's ridiculous.
I don't understand that predisposed opinion, Manny, but I
know. Okay, let's fast forward to 2016. John, let's assume Marco Rubio is on the ticket. Do you see most conservative white males getting behind him?
2016, Simon. I got to get through the next 4 years. I really don't care, but I would like to say, as far as hardworking immigrants, we've always been a nation of immigrants, and I would like to recommend, which I do, I'm probably the only person, I tip the guy at Taco Bell. So I would like to start that trend.
Yeah, but most of the time he's white, John, so what does that have to do with anything else?
Well, he's not,
he's
man.
He's white, he's got long hair, and he says dude to you, which you understand from your high school days. And since you still speak dude after all those years in high school, it's not a reach.
Well, whichever Taco Bell I frequent, I always tip the people. So, and a lot of
okay.
them do have to be
John,
Mexican.
Once again, you're playing a politician and avoiding the question.
Yeah, John, what happened? Did you lose your spine on the way to the show?
You guys are asking me about 2016. Come on, the Cubs could win 4 pennants by then. I don't know.
The Browns won't win one Super Bowl. I can guarantee you that.
Oh, Lord. Okay. John, I'm not going to let you off the hook. All right. Do you see the white male Republican voters getting behind Marco Rubio should he choose to run.
Of course. And not only that, I'm willing to start a grassroots organization in Southern California, Alan West in 2016.
You know, John, and you're telling me that you don't do drugs. It's hard to believe anybody could say that without being delusional on drugs.
Benny, I give my honest opinion, and I'm to fame for it.
Okay. What, when have I ever taken your honest opinion into consideration?
I answer the question, and then I'm criticized. So,
well, if you like, I'll criticize you before. So,
I love,
you know,
Marco
please,
Rubio and Alan West, and
yeah,
all of my
right.
friends do as well. So,
so
I,
how
I
do you feel about out. That, Peter? Do you think that Marco Rubio is a Latino will ever get a nomination out of the Republican Party? I'm sorry, I'm doing my Jim Moore impersonation today.
Well, it may seem far-fetched, but John's right about a certain thing. I mean, who knows what's going to happen in the next 4 years? And if he represents their best chance of success, then I couldn't say it's beyond the realm of possibility. But we talk about the existence of racism, and Manny, you pointed out that there's probably a natural component to it that is present in all people. We tend to fear, or at least have concerns about difference, and these fears and concerns are constantly being fanned the more we're exposed to difference. And you're seeing a lot of for lack of a better phrase, a bit of a renaissance of racism in America today, in my opinion, because people are really scared right now. They're scared of the fact that we have an African-American president, and they're afraid of things like jobs flowing overseas and foreign cultures dominating us and taking over our country. At least that's the perception. And I think these pressures are probably it's unclear to me the degree to which the next 4 years are going to alleviate some of these concerns or increase them. It's very unpredictable. I was really shocked to see the revival in racism that I saw after the last election, and I think there's a lot of fear and concern out there, and who knows how that's going to play out. But it will be interesting to see how it plays out over the next 4 years. I suspect it's actually going to die down, but that's hard to predict.
I think the racism is directly proportionate to the economy, and that is what it amounts to in every country is that, and it's true everywhere in the world, which is sort of a redundant statement now that I've made it, is that when people have a lot of money, life is easy. It's easy to be tolerant. When you got to compete for a job, then you look for ways to improve your competition. So suddenly it becomes an issue whether your competitor is a woman because, after all, she should be at home, or it's a minority race because, after all, they don't belong here. So, and usually I think historically racism is at its worst among blue-collar workers, et cetera, who feel the highest level of competitive problems with minorities. And as a result, if our economy doesn't get better, you can be assured that racism will get worse. It's really that simple. And it's a sad commentary on the human existence, but it's a very real commentary. Sam, you're seeing that a lot of that where you live, where the economics of the area have pitted blacks against whites, and it is a problem there, isn't it?
Yes, it started with busing, forced busing. I'm sure it started way before then, but that was really, really, I remember the rocks and the eggs and, people being bussed across town and just didn't want to go and that whole thing, and that was terrible. And then, of course, those people fought in the steel mills, even though they had worked together, but it was like when they... It was terrible, but then as the economy went down, it got worse and worse to where we are right now, where the inner city of Youngstown is the neighborhoods of Decatur, the literally little Detroits, John, the neighborhoods. And the funny part is the powers that be have decided with tax dollars, with incentives, with whatnot, to build an oasis in this war zone called the downtown area. And they put all their money into this area, and they put an illusion that there's these jobs and success and whatnot, and they can't understand why the neighborhoods are mad, they're upset, they're pissed off, there's still shooting going on, there's still there's not every weekend there's major mayhem in the surrounding neighborhoods in the inner city, and the powers that be in the media, they scratch their heads, they go, well, why? We made this beautiful downtown. We put a convention center down here. We had Elton John here over the summer. Why is this happening? Why isn't it getting better? And I agree with you, man. It's because of the economics. And in this case, it's the powers that be picking winners and losers, and they've decided the winner is a downtown that they can show off and be happy at and the losers are the neighborhood, which I've always thought, the heart of any big city. The downtown is the heart, but the neighborhoods are the veins carrying the blood back and forth. And in this area, they just cut it all off, and it's created all sorts of economic problems and, of course, racism, because 50% of the city is African-American and 50% of the city is white. And probably only 10% of them are probably actually productive, working, whether it's for the government or private sector, and the other 80% are all on handouts. And it's creating a lot of racial tensions, things that I thought disappeared after a while. We're seeing a lot more people driving by shooting up houses in the better part of the community. Of course, that never happened before. But you could tell it was a white neighborhood, and I don't think it was a white person driving around to downtown, but maybe it was. Maybe it was, or in the African-American community, the same sort of thing. Certain houses are being charted. People are pissed off. They want money. If somebody else has something better than them, they're taking it now, or they're destroying it, or they're trying to bring the rest of the community down to their level so they feel better about themselves.
Sam, a quick question for you. What is the population of Youngstown? Because not everyone is familiar with it.
Okay. Everyone knows the city.
It used to be in its heyday, the steel mills in the 50s, it was over 250,000, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And now it's down to 70,000, give or take five. Our surrounding community, the suburb, the edge suburbs and the outer suburb, I live in one of the outer suburbs, is probably 200,000. So, at one point, Youngstown, we're no bigger as a county. We're the seventh largest county in Ohio out of the 88. Our county is actually just a little bit bigger than the city of Youngstown was in its heyday after World War II.
Sam, the last time I was there, one of my former in-laws, because they've all passed away, told me that she refused to eat any more at her favorite Perkins restaurant, which is a local chain there, because she went in there and there were African Americans having a meal there, and she wouldn't eat in the same restaurant with them. And I said to myself, geez, what year are we in? And those prejudices from that, our so-called greatest generation, one of the things Brokaw never really mentioned was how anti-Semitic and anti-black that generation was. And that's the hidden story about them. They were as racist as any group I've ever known and as a lawyer ever represented, because, God, I represented a ton of them, because in my generation, they were the ones who had all the money. They became wealthy.
Well, what's interesting, it sounds really weird. A friend of mine was pointing this out about the thaw. There was just like a thaw up until the last couple of years in because of high school football around here. I know that sounds weird, everybody, but a lot of the schools went to open enrollment, which means the families that wanted to get out of the crappy schools, the inner city, no matter how much money. And John's right. They, at least in Youngstown, they spent millions, billions on a decaying population to build up these brand new schools. And the schools stink. So when a lot of the suburbs went to open enrollment because they get money. The more people they have in the school, the more money they get from the state, et cetera. So it's all a big money to grab. But anyway, the football teams all got better. because African, now all the schools weren't all white. They now had a, they had African Americans coming in who could play sports and were really good at it, you know. And the family was happy. The kids were getting a better education, meeting different people. And it was kind of really strange. It was just like thaw. And it was because of sports. You know, we would go to, when I played here, when I was 35 years ago, my school was all, there was 8,000 kids in my high school. It was all white. It was, and we played a school in the inner city. It was all black. And I mean, you're talking fights happened all the time. Now, hardly any of that happens because they all go to the football game, the mixed races, and everyone wants to see a damn good football game. And that's what they do see. And no. So that did have a good effect, but now, you know, the talent polluted and this and that, and there were some fights this year at some of the games, and I always just said, geez, it's because we had all crappy teams in this county this year. There was no good football. No one was going to the games. There was no team that the community could rally around for the state championship as there had been, and there was all sorts of, we went back to where we were 6-7 years ago with all this racism now with the high school sports. It's terrible. I hope it stops.
So let me throw one into that. Twofold, as John will attest, enrollment in Southern California in schools has been a hotbed issue among, you know, who's eligible and who is eligible. Even worse in basketball, where players have shifted trying to find teams that they might be able to win the state title on and showcase their skills better for college, and that's been a problem. But the ultimate issue that was demonstrated in 1970 when USC went down to Alabama and just stomped on the Tide and allowed Bear Bryant to convince the school to basically integrate because they didn't want to be embarrassed by schools who had so many black players who could just beat the crap out of them. But for that, the South would probably still have integration problems. And it's not just my opinion. There have been a number of books written on it. I don't know, Peter, if that was within your time of being a sports fan, but Sam Cunningham just basically ran all over the Tide, and that was it for integration issues. They could not stand to lose football so much, they changed their policies. Isn't that weird?
Bam the Bam Cunningham, one of my favorites.
Yep. Yeah.
Father of Randall.
Yep. I watched when I grew up in Boston before I moved out in Ohio. He was drafted by the Patriots and was he had a pretty good career with the Patriots. I don't know what happened to him afterwards. I don't think he got hurt or something.
I saw Sam at a reunion dinner about 2 years ago, and he's doing great. He's back in his home in Santa Barbara and just doing great. His younger brother, I don't know what he's doing. The former quarterback of, you know, the Philadelphia Eagles,
right, Randall.
Randall, but Sam was probably the best decathlete I ever saw in my life. He would have been an Olympic gold medalist had he stuck to it. And John McKay once said his biggest mistake in his career was not playing him more and running him more. But he played on a team with Lynn Swann, Anthony Davis. Remember Alan Carter also played for New England? He was the backup running back on that with Anthony Davis, Rod McNeil, who played for New Orleans. Both Pat Hayden and Mike Ray played pro football. There were 43 players on that team that went in the NFL, and they just didn't have enough room to play everybody, and that was one of his great regrets in his career. But, yeah, that game changed the South. And you're right, sports is a great unifying factor. And it was even in South Africa, if you remember the famous story about the South African soccer team. But at some point, it all ends, and these wonderful moments pass, and people revert to who they are. And part of the racism problem is a difference in customs. People are used to their customs. Other races come in, they have different customs, they have different beliefs. And I'll use this as an example. John and I have discussed this. I think you and I did too, Sam, once. If you watch Major League Baseball, you will see a big difference between the players from the Caribbean islands and the black players from the United States. And you'll see that sometimes they're not really very compatible. They don't spend a lot of time together. And one reason is they come from different cultures. And even though they have the same racial background, the players from the Caribbean are raised as Roman Catholics, and the African Americans are raised as Baptists, generally speaking. And what I've observed throughout this period of time is that their religious beliefs change who they are. And you'll see that most of the Latino players from the who are black from the Caribbean don't have a lot of issues. They don't, except for a certain manager who used to be in Chicago and got fired in Miami. Most of them aren't hotheads. They don't get into social problems. They don't do other things like that. But the African Americans tend to run, play, party, and the other ones go home to their children and more family oriented. So some of this is a pure cultural difference between religions, and I thought that was also one of the problems with the Irish moving here, is the Irish were basically Catholics in an otherwise Protestant country. So I think that fuels it too, don't you?
Oh, okay, I'm going to upset this apple cart. I want to change subjects. Obama, in his first term, bailed out the banks. He bailed out the auto manufacturers. Should he step in and bail out the hostess Twinkie?
Now, this will be the first one. John, okay, now how can you turn down a government that would bail out a hostess Twinkie?
Manny, I said it. In that case, I might be willing to make an exception. I wanted to ask you guys a quick trivia question. Who was the first black player in the Southwest Conference?
Okay. I'll give everybody a hint. He was a four-year tight end at Alabama, and he's the general manager.
Manny, the Southwest. Before.
Oh, the Southwest Conference. No, I don't remember the Southwest.
Yeah.
Sam? Okay, John. Who?
You have any guesses, Sam?
Southwest?
I think it was
1966.
No. That would be even born. It's Jerry Levias from SMU.
Oh, really? I didn't remember that. Jerry Levias was? Wow.
You'd like that. But as far as the Twinkies, I might have to make an exception in that case, Simon, for personal reasons.
You all think that I'm being frivolous, but I'm not. The hostess bakery.
Sam, it's time for the Twinkies to die. That's time. Okay? That's my opinion.
Oh, my God. What will people use for murder defenses now, Peter?
Wasn't that great? Wasn't that brilliant that it was actually a murder defense? Does everybody know that?
Yeah. Dan White.
Okay. You've interrupted my train of thought, but it's too good. It's too good not to run with. Peter, tell us the infamous Twinkie defense.
Well, if anybody ever saw the movie Milk Representative Milk, I think it was City Councilman Milk up in San Francisco. Well, he was
Harvey Milk.
Harvey Milk, forgive me, Sean Penn, and the other city councilman who murdered him pleaded some type of diminished capacity or insanity defense, then said that it was brought on by eating too many Twinkies, and that there were all these additives and substances in Twinkies. And this was a novel defense at the time, and it worked. It worked. The jury bought it, and I forget what happened to him. He got convicted. Manny, was there a retrial, or what happened?
No.
Because
they sent him to a mental institution for a while, and then he was finally released. It was odd because he moved to Studio City, not too far from me. And then one day, sort of like they reveal predators in the neighborhood, there I got up, turned on my news and found out that Dan White was living in my neighborhood.
Dan White, that's right. It was Dan White.
Dan White. Oh yeah, and Moscone was the mayor. And so anyway, to make a long story short, I just couldn't stop laughing. And people acted like he was a serial killer in the neighborhood. But, oh, yeah, everybody was offended by that plea. But the truth is, the guy was pretty messed up psychologically, and he was, you know, just not too tightly wrapped, which, you know, I mean, come on, how many guys go out and shoot
look,
the mayor?
Look, he was clearly a Twinkie, and if you are what you eat, there's some credibility to the defense there. But I am also, I'm sorry to say this, I'm also a big believer in karma and fate, and what happened to him? He ended up killing himself, didn't he?
That's correct. He finally committed suicide. But, you know, but that was his karma. The guy was, you know, basically a mentally disturbed human being, and he was going to do it to himself sooner than later, and he eventually did. So, you know, that wasn't a huge surprise. And guess what? People who commit those kind of crimes, when I hear people say, oh, yeah, they're sane enough to stand trial, and without getting into our understanding of the various definitions of insanity, sometimes I break out laughing.
Yeah.
You know?
And sometimes, I know this is a contrarian thought, but sometimes the worst thing you can do for yourself is actually, quote-unquote, get away with the crime, because I believe there's a certain part of everybody that haunts them for these kinds of things, and there are plenty of examples of that. But in any event,
Not to mention O.J. Simpson, which...
Well, I wasn't going to name the most obvious, but
I do believe
that was a big part
friend.
Of it.
Yeah, that was
a big part of it. I think he was just troubled by all of it.
Oh, and I can tell you, as a 40-year friend of his, there's no question in any of our minds, those of us who know him could see that in him. I had trouble accepting he was guilty till I watched how he handled it, and I was just so upset by it all. You know, it was horrible. And yes, someone who's basically moral, who commits an immoral crime as Simpson did, sooner or later it catches up with them, and they cannot sleep at night. They can't deal with the consequences of their act, hating to steal an insanity issue, and basically do harm themselves eventually because they cannot handle who they are versus what they've done. And Simpson is a classic example of that.
I have to break in. Sam, what do you think? Should Obama step in and rescue the Twinkie?
Well, I no, he shouldn't, but it doesn't matter because if you read Manny's book, the Twinkies are so full of chemicals to live on forever and ever and ever as long as no one eats them.
Yeah.
So
maybe the government should step in if Hostess manufactured products differently or made them more wholesome or whatever, but then it would still be the death of the Twinkie. So
yeah, I think the Twinkie dies if the Twinkies need to die. I mean, it's a bad state of affairs for management, ownership, and whatnot. I think Manny, you pointed out last week that they've been in and out of bankruptcy, and you know the usual guys will get the we'll get the dough, and the other people won't. And it's a sad thing. If Twinkies is that big of a seller, and the other products are the ones that don't sell, wouldn't they sell the rights to the name and the recipe?
They certainly will. But here's the problem. All right, we want to generate jobs and. Hostess Bakery, bless their little cotton hearts, they make Twinkies, Ho-Hos, and a variety of...
Ding-dongs in the community.
heart-clogging...
really bad things. Bread.
Right. Wonder Bread. But they employ 18,000 people to dump the Twinkie puts 18,000 people unemployed. What do you do?
Why is the company failing?
You know why they're failing? Is because they have reorganized, manipulated, were bought using the old debt principles that major corporations were using during mergers and acquisitions, and they squeezed all the cash out of it and basically destroyed the company until there was nothing left. And after draining it like this, they started blaming the employees for increases in wages when they're basically the management is the culprit in this. It's one of the most deceitful closings I've seen in a long time. And the management there is really unsympathetic. They all should be shot for doing this, except the fact is, as I've said, they're really the only thing good Twinkies are good for are some kind of military rations in the event of war. I mean, there's no benefit to this stuff.
Part of the new economy that everybody is suffering through is this kind of rebooting process. And there are companies that are providing products that the world needs and wants. Well, wants maybe needs may be going too far. And there are others that clearly aren't. And they're not surviving the evolutionary test of the new economy. And I don't see any reason why Hostess should. I feel bad for 18,000 people who are going to be unemployed, but this is happening across the sector, and presumably they have skills which will translate over. But I don't think we should bail out Hostess just for the sake of maintaining jobs.
I was actually only joking.
Well, now you did the bait and switch. You said you were serious, and now you say you're joking. I don't know what to believe anymore. You're like the host of a radio talk show. I don't know.
Nah, he's just terminally British. You get used to it. We're running over, Simon. I don't know how much you want to go with all of this, but before we end this, John, we've been picking on you a lot, and you deserve it, but we appreciate the contrary views, because somewhere out there, somewhere is the one person who does agree with you, and he's happy that you're speaking for him. And I think it's important that that one person's views be represented somewhere, somehow. So, but in the meantime,
oh, that was really mean.
Well, that's right. He's buying lunch, and UCLA is going to lose this week, too. So I figure I can afford it till he gets me with a victory. Then he's going to beat on me like an old drum. Right, John?
Manny, I think you were exaggerating with one.
Who'd UCLA play this week?
They play Stanford again.
Okay, we are running over, so I do need to wrap this program up. So let's start with you, John. You've been quiet. Give us your parting salvo.
All right, Simon, I'm going to engage in some circular reasoning here and defend the capitalist pigs of the world. I'd like to give your listeners something to think about, because these mental gymnastics and contortions Manny has to jump through in his reasoning are very entertaining to me. So I actually did some myself. So try to follow me here, Simon. If you want, write this down, because I extrapolated. That means extended out to Manny's reasoning. All right, this country is a capitalist, greedy society. Mitt Romney, of course, embodied that. Yet half of the population subsidized. Since half of the population subsidized, they think they're victims. They think they're victims, yet their representatives, Obama, run the government. Their representatives run the government, but they keep getting poorer. They keep getting poorer, yet they believe people in other countries want to come here and dream about being like them. So they think that people want to come here and dream about living here, yet their goal is to make America more like the other countries.
Okay.
Right. Okay.
That was clever, John, but not very effective.
John, that was deep and philosophic.
It's paraphrased from one of my idols, Milton Friedman.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Sam.
I want to thank everybody for being on the show and talk. It's been a great wide range in discussion. I kind of like you really hitting on racism. That was for the bulk of it, and of course Israel versus Hamas. I thought those were really two good subjects. All four of us tackled very well, or five of us. And wonderful Thanksgiving. I hope all of you did. Everybody in the listening audience, I hope you did too. And Simon, you teased me with your emails this weekend. I'm kind of mad at you. I thought we were going to talk about the Casey Anthony thing. So I was all geared up for that. You throw out the hostess bailout.
Oh, hey, we'll do Casey next week. Don't panic. Casey's like a Twinkie. Yeah, she has
she would
no
like a Twinkie.
Sell-by date.
She wants a Twinkie.
I thought she had her 3 minutes of fame.
Peter, the voice of reason.
Oh, well, it just reminded me that this is Thanksgiving weekend, and I reminded myself by participating today of the things I'm grateful for. And I'm grateful we talked about hostess because the Casey Anthony case is going to be here for a while, and that's more than I can say for hostess. And I am very grateful for John Perry because I do believe he speaks for somewhere between 49 to 50% of the nation, but just not the majority right now. And I'm grateful for all of you. This was a great discussion today. I look forward to next week. And I hope we all survive the new year because we've got impending doom on the horizon. Don't forget about that.
The 21st of December, end
that's
of
right.
Mayan calendar.
And
that
I am rooting, as a Stanford undergrad and a UCLA grad, I'm rooting for Stanford because I'm trying to get all my crazy hippie college friends back into town for the Rose Bowl, and I'm hoping.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with it. There's only two teams I love to root against, generally it's Stanford and Notre Dame, but lately I've been rooting for Stanford, and I don't know how to explain that to my fellow Trojans, but I somehow or another have adopted them. I just really like this team.
They're fun to watch.
Yeah, no, I like the way, I like the heart, I like their attitude, and I love to see guys with good grades kicking ass, because it doesn't happen very often, right?
No.
Okay, Peter, I will say this. The 21st of December is a Saturday. Assuming the world is still intact on the 22nd, we will do a special about the end of the Mayan calendar.
Well, that's good. That gives us all time to prepare. I'm watching Doomsday Preppers regularly so that I could get ready.
Right.
I've already bought a bunch of bottled water. Oh, never mind.
and Manny, your parting shot for the day.
You know, I'm blessed with a lot of good friends. I'm blessed with a lot of good people on this show, and I think our listeners are blessed by our nonsense. And I want to wish everybody not only a happy Thanksgiving, but the holidays start. We've got a debt cliff to worry about. We got the Mayan calendar to be concerned about. We had that horrible Hobbit approaching the movie theaters, so we're going to be invaded by CGI creatures. So love your family. Get your weapons out. Buy a few more since Obama's president. And get ready. It's going to be a colorful Christmas. Merry Christmas and have a wonderful holiday season. Why now? Because it's Black Friday, and you can't possibly start wishing people a Merry Christmas soon enough. Go ahead, Simon.
Yeah. Well, Black Friday, you know, should be called Jail Friday. I'm not sure how many people got arrested.
No,
anyway.
It should be known as Credit Card Friday.
Well, here's something to think about. Why did it get called Black Friday? Maybe we can answer that next week.
I can answer you now. From the red to the black and profits, right. Thank you.
That's
you're welcome. I know that. Okay. Next year it'll be Black Wednesday. It's going to start. It's already creeped in the Thursday, so it'll be Wednesday.
Okay, gentlemen, I want to thank you so much, and hopefully we can do this all again next Sunday. Until then, I want to thank you, and I want to thank
all of our listeners. So be safe, be healthy, and we'll be back next week. Till then, goodbye.
Take care. Anybody?